Our guest today is Stephen Puri, and it's kind of hard to sum Stephen up in a single sentence or even a paragraph. He's built cutting-edge visual effects for blockbuster films like Independence Day, which won an Oscar for those effects. He's helped shape major franchises like Die Hard as a Hollywood exec. Now he's creating tools to help people focus better and live more meaningful lives. What connects all of this is Stephen's work at the intersection of creativity, technology, and human experience. Whether he's producing stories on screen or designing software to help people reclaim their focus, he's asking big questions about how we work, what gets in the way, and how we create things that matter. So in today's conversation, we'll hear about the lessons he's learned from being a teenage news anchor, a software developer, a film exec, and a startup founder, and we'll explore things like how studios manage risk on multi-million dollar creative bets, what it really takes to get into a flow state and stay there, and we'll hear what inspired Stephen's latest venture, The Suka. So if you lead creative work or want to do more of it yourself, this episode's for you. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Peter, that is a beautiful introduction. And for those listening in their cars or at home or at the gym, I hope this is not only entertaining, but has some actionable sort of tips about how to be more healthy and productive.
Love it. So I mentioned that you were a teenage news anchor and you sort of giggled a little bit.
I haven't heard much
about your time there. And I'm curious, that's a formative time in our lives. I'm curious what lessons or skills or anything from that time sort of set you up for later roles in film and tech and in your life in general.
Well, I'll tell you, my life has been a series of very lucky breaks, like things that fell in my lap, coupled with how do I work really hard to make something of this, right?
Yeah.
So the thing you reference, which a lot of places where I speak, they don't do their research as much as you did, so my hat is off. I was in D.C., and there was a show which was the top-rated youth show in the D.C. Baltimore market, which was a half-hour news show. And sort of the shtick of the show was all of the hosts were in high school. So if you got people in D.C. or Baltimore, even politicians, like we had the mayor on, we had boxers, we had people in the community on, because you want to be like down with the kids. It was the show where you'd be like, oh, let's have, the high schoolers ask us, let's go, what's going on with the metro or whatever, right? So I did that for 6 to 9 weeks. Super fun. Probably the most fun thing when you're like in high school was every now and then you'd go to a restaurant and someone come up and be like, oh my God, I've seen you on TV. It's flattering. I'm not going to lie. It was kind of fun, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're trying to, figure out how to deal with your own acne, So that was interesting. The thing it led to is this, and why it's an important sort of turn in my life, which is I was in, obviously, Northern Virginia, Washington, D.C. area, had never contemplated going to the West Coast, but USC, which has a very strong journalism school, spotted me and said, hey, if you want to come to USC, we have the Annenberg School and would love for you to come out here. So they were very generous with me. And that led to suddenly I'm in Los Angeles. And what you hadn't mentioned in those early years is I happened to fall into doing this TV show, but I actually was a code monkey. Both my parents were engineers at IBM, and when your mom's like a professional ice skater, you learn to ice skate, right? So I would go to the University Computing Center sometimes with my mom and, she'd teach me how to code. These are obviously antiquated languages now, but at the time it was like, oh my God, we're doing this thing, right? So when I was at USC, I was a Watson scholar for IBM, which meant not only money, but also I had a job whenever I wanted it. I could make money during school programming. So I ended up, thanks to that TV show, which is one of those weird Forrest Gump kind of moments, going to Los Angeles. And I was there when film went digital. And I happened to understand a bit of both. And that helped my career tremendously.
You started forming companies to do visual effects at that intersection, right? I'm imagining at IBM, you weren't doing visual focused computer graphics, right?
Oh, good God, no. It was the division of IBM that did the DoD work. The Federal Systems Division. So I was responsible for the program that said, hey, we have a contract that 4 years from now on a Tuesday, we have to deliver this submarine box or this F-14 box or this signal processor for a helicopter to talk to a carrier, right? Let's go back in time and explode out everything to today where it tells us like tomorrow afternoon, if you don't order these three screws, you will not deliver that 4 years from now, right? That sort of coverage analysis. I tell you that because you're right. I did not go to USC, go to Los Angeles with a deep training in, how to make computer-generated film. But what did happen was this. While I was there and earning money at IBM, coding boring stuff, relatively, in my dorm, a lot of my friends, because USC has a great cinema TV school, arguably the best in the world, they're young Spielbergs and aspiring Lucases and, you know, Scorseses. So yeah, you go out on Tuesday night, you watch a movie, you all debate it afterwards at dinner, and I developed a decent vocabulary of film. So when computers suddenly could handle rasterizing an entire film frame, manipulating it in the computer, holding it all in RAM, and outputting it back to a film frame, that opened up a whole world, and not a lot of people sat in that Venn diagram, could speak to an engineer, could speak to a director. I sat right there, and that's how I got into visual effects. It was like, hey, kid, come here. You know how to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's cool. So did you work for another visual effects company before you founded your own, or did you just say, you know what, I'm here? Tell us a little bit about that journey from there to Centropolis.
I went to the West Coast office of a graphic design company that did a lot of like television, stuff like that, called R. Greenberg Associates. And while I was there, learned a lot about graphic design, learned about computer-generated graphics for film, right? And did a bunch of movies. Did True Lies with Cameron, did Seven with Fincher, did Sweetland Film stuff with Woody Allen, did Jim Jarmusch movies. With a lot of directors. So it was really interesting. Met Roland Emmerich and Ian Devlin when they were coming off Stargate. And they had this script for this B movie at Fox. You know, the big ambitions of the guys that have no money, right?
Yeah.
And the original budget on Independence Day was $73 million, right? Which now is laughable when you think about it. Yeah. But at the time, it was all Fox would give them because they're like, hey, you're the Stargate Universal Soldier guys. But they asked me if I would come on production. I would leave the company where we did all this work and say, come work with us on the feature side. We had this idea of how to make this $73 million budget work. We have to set up almost like within the feature, a digital arm with computer graphics engineers, you know, both animators, renderers, lighters, technical directors, and all this. So we did that. And it was incredibly hard. And I'll tell you, one of the things I learned about studio life was, imagine you needed a pencil, Peter. And Fox gave you a form. They're like, fill this out in triplicate to get your pencil, right? So you put in this requisition. 3 weeks later, you call Fox. You're like, hey, that pencil. And they're like, yeah, we lost your form. Fill it out again, right? We were like the ugly stepchild. And then if you remember, there was a trailer that came out where the White House blew up. The Monday after that trailer played, Fox called and they were like, hey, do you need anything? Of course, we were like, can we have the pencil?
Does
remember like a month ago, I filled out that rec for the pencil. And they're like, no, do you need? And they named some like $1 million Silicon Graphics equipment. And we're like, are you kidding? And I realize now that's what happens when like the studio's searching for what's going to be the hit and they lock onto you. And then suddenly you are like the chosen one. And they were like, all we care is you make the release date. The movie's called Independence Day. It needs to come out on time. And we realize now this could be a hit. And it ended up being the third highest grossing movie in the history of film, right? That was an interesting process. Roland and Dean and I got along really well. When we were in post-production, you know, which is, you know, 24 hours a day going to sound studios, visual effects studios, we would go just walking around the studio and we talked about, why don't we just set up a company together? So that's what we did. I co-founded a company with them and raised about $15 million of venture debt. Mm-hmm. And super fun.
So you were at Centropolis, you ended up selling that, exiting at Centropolis. And then what was it like moving from that sort of specialist visual effects provider to what I'm assuming are broader responsibilities, because you then became a VP at 20th Century Fox and then eventually an executive VP at DreamWorks. What was it like moving from I'm focused on this to I have a broader remit now?
Do you remember your 20s when you were pretty certain you were so smart, you knew everything, you were invincible, like everything? You know, remember that? Okay. We sold Centropolis to a German company called Das Werk, sort of like Liberty Media of Germany, right? And that was a great exit. We made a 6x return. I took 2 years off and, of course, thought I was really smart and selling companies is easy. Wait for that, because we're going to come back to how foolish that was. So when I had my moment of like, okay, I feel like I've taken the foot off the accelerator, you know, working 120 hours a week to finish movies and stuff really burns you out. So I had a great moment to do that. I thought, you know what? I don't want to wake up, be 30, 40, 50 years old be making the effects for someone else's movie. Like, I've kind of done 14 movies at this point. I get it. And I was like, how do I get to be the guy who helps make a movie, not make a piece of someone else's movie? So I set my goal on, I want to go be like a chairman of a studio or some senior executive at a studio and, you know, learn that process. And yeah, went to Sony as a junior executive, went to a production company at DreamWorks, ended up an executive vice president there with Alex Gertz and Bob Orsi, who are great guys, who are actually, Bob sadly just died a few weeks ago, but who were great guys and, you know, very talented writers. They're the guys who wrote Transformers, Star Trek 11, you know, Mission Impossible 3, The Island, Zorro, tons of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And then I went to Fox and was the VP overseeing like the Die Hard franchises you mentioned, the Wolverine franchise, stuff like that. So that was kind of my goal of like, okay, how do I get a movie made?
Uh-huh. And so for people that are transitioning from a more specialist role to a broad mm-hmm. role, what are some things that you learned? What advice would you give to somebody who's in that first time, I'm in a much broader role now, now what?
Okay. I did some crazy stuff. So I'm not going to recommend other people do that, but I will answer your question because you asked it, Peter, okay? So yeah. What I'm about to say, kids, don't try this at home, okay?
Good, Later? Good. Here's what to avoid, okay. Yes.
So I have a couple strong theses in life. One is we all have something great inside us, and the question of our life is, will it get out or not? Okay? That's one thesis. Second thesis, be around the smartest people you can find. It is better to go mop the floors for, you know, Steve Jobs or whomever, you know, you want to be around than it is to be the executive vice president for a CEO where you're like, actually, she's dumb, you know? So I applied that here. When we sold Centropolis, I mentioned to you, I took 2 years off, traveled, it was really great. You know, been president of a company in my 20s, thought it was super cool, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I came back and I had a new mission going into, you know, around my 30th birthday. I was like, I want to be this new thing. Had lunch with a bunch of friends who were producers that I'd met and said, hey, man, you know, I'm this hotshot. I want to do this stuff. And several friends straight up told me, you don't know what you're asking for. Like, you think because you know Jim Cameron, Fincher, or Mel Gibson, I've done Braveheart, but you know them on a first name basis and they recognize you, that they're looking to you to help them make movies. They're not. They look at you as a craftsman, right? The same way you would greet like a valet.
Uh-huh.
Right? You know Joe, but you're certainly not looking for him to run your company, right? Mm-hmm. Just park the car. So I was like, wow, okay, ego blow, got it. So then what? They're like, there's a whole new world of people that you need to meet. If you want to be involved upstream in developing ideas, finding writers, finding properties, packaging them with directors, with actors, like that is a new set of people you need to meet, a new vocabulary you need to learn, a new way of working. So put your ego on the shelf. You should treat it like grad school and you should go be an assistant for 2 years. Mm. Work 1 year for a seller, an agent or manager, 1 year for a buyer, studio executive. And several friends said this in the same week over the different lunches.
Oh, I was
like, they're probably not wrong.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's hard to listen to because I thought I'm like this hotshot, but wow. So I went to do exactly that. And I had to dumb down my resume, you know, because I went out on one interview and they're like, the top line of resume is you're president of an effects company. That movie won an Academy Award. Like, what are you doing trying to be an assistant here? This is ridiculous, right? Uh-huh. So I learned how to, you know, change my resume. So the top line was intern. And I just went and interned somewhere for free, put it at the top line. I learned in Hollywood, no one reads the second line. So the second line was President Centropolis, but the top line said intern, some in entertainment.
Yeah.
I went in on the next job interview. They're like, ah, great. When can you start? I'm like, now, not working. Available right now.
Uh-huh.
And I got the job. So I worked for a year and a half for the seller of talent, essentially a talent manager who did like Anne Hathaway, Kira Sedgwick, and Barbara Hershey, and we were on Toby and Kirsten's team, stuff like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to go work for a buyer to learn that side of the conversation,
right?
How do sellers talk and how do buyers talk? And I'm working for the president of Paramount. And both those gave me a network, gave me a lexicon, gave me an understanding of how the business worked that then launched my career. And that's how I ended up executive vice president and, you know, all the other stuff. That was a transition. And by the way, my dad, the first time he called me at work and I answered the phone with like, you know, hey, Peter's office. My dad was like, what happened? Like, he's like, you can tell me, did you get fired? Like, why are you a secretary? I'm like, number one, it's called assistant. Number two, I have a plan, Dad.
That's great. I'm curious, when you got to those roles, right? Now you are in the chair.
Yes.
What surprised you about the job?
I'll tell you, I learned in between the DreamWorks and the Fox experiences how much leaders set a culture.
Uh-huh.
It was the most marked difference I had ever seen in my young career. You could sum it up like this. DreamWorks was a studio still run by a filmmaker, the only one still run by a filmmaker, right? It was Steven and Stacy when I was there. There was definitely a sense of, tonight, Peter, go home, look at the movies you're working on, and see if you can make them 1% better. After 4 years there, and a bunch of success, just I'm very grateful for, Fox recruited me. Very appealing. Hey, we'll double your salary. Do you want to run the Die Hard franchise? You probably grew up watching Die Hard movies. You could be the guy on Die Hard 5. Like, you want Wolverine? We're going to do a Wolverine, right? Wow. It was hard to say no. So I went there, even though some friends were like, dude, I don't think you're going to be a culture fit. I don't think you're going to like this.
Mm-hmm.
That culture was, hey, Peter, could you go home tonight and make your movies 1% cheaper? It's called show business. It's not called show art. There is a valid reason why one of the two chairmen, my bosses there, came from that mentality. It's a business. There are profits, there are, you know, margins, there are shareholders, there's Chase to report to, and he reports to Rupert, you know, like there are a lot of reasons for that. But 2 years there killed my soul.
Those two examples seem like almost like they're stereotypes of the two competing forces in Hollywood, right?
Yes.
You have sort of the creative side that wants to make great art. You have the suits that want to cut costs and do the seventh sequel because the formula works and we know we'll put butts in seats with that, right?
Yeah. My boss was proud that he was the guy who thought to put Alien versus Predator in the same movie.
So there's always that tension in Hollywood. I'm curious what you noticed the leaders doing. Was it just that vision that you described where on one side it's make the movie 1% better and the other side it's make the movie 1% cheaper? Because I think leaders want to set a culture and often they say, I want the culture to be like this. And then it's hard to do. What have you seen them do that actually creates a culture or shifts a culture in a direction?
I noticed that there are really two things that a leader can actually do in that role, which is you set a vision, you set a style. So you say, we're all here because we're going to cure cancer, make zero pollution vehicles, make movies for families, whatever it is, right? You set a vision and hopefully that vision attracts the right people. In your hiring process, you get people who want to cure cancer, make EVs, make Disney movies, right? The second thing is the style, where it is, this is how we will treat each other. This is how we will treat our clients and, you know, vendors. And this is how we will treat our competitors. And wow, that made a big impression on me because, you know, it is like Iago says in Othello, where he's talking about, you know, good name in man and woman. You end up seeing the same people again and again. Your reputation, like whether you honor your word, it will serve you or it will destroy you over time. And I've made mistakes. I'm not saying this is like, I've done everything right. I have not. I have definitely learned that through, oh man, I did this. This worked out really well. I did that. Boy, was that a mistake. Uh-huh. Man, if I could do that over, I'd do that differently.
Yeah.
And tried to, you know, apologize when appropriate and tried to celebrate and share the things that I've done well. That's probably the successes of my life have really come from that.
Let's shift gears a little bit and talk about risk. Because studios are making these big multi-million dollar bets and lots of businesses, when they're imagining a new product or an extension or a project that they're going to work on, they try to reduce risk by doing extensive detailed planning, right? Everybody in a room, map out every feature we're going to build that doesn't work well. Like, we've developed a whole process called CAPED that helps us overcome this. And in previous episodes of the show, we described how Pixar, right? At least pre-Disney, it's hard to know exactly what's going on inside right now.
Yep.
Yeah. They used a much more active approach to planning, where planning essentially was iterating on the film. A director would own a film with a writer and they would iterate on it with these really rough cuts, right? Where like they're doing the voices, right?
This goes back to Disney. this is Disney from 50 years ago. They basically said what worked at Disney in the heyday, and they modeled it with computers.
Interesting. It's all full circle, right? And and then they'd bring it into the brain trust meeting, right? Where all of the directors and anyone else that they thought would give good feedback would give good feedback.
You know this well, yes.
And they would just hammer on the film scene by scene and say, the story doesn't work here. I don't know why this character's doing this. And none of those are edicts to say, go do this or that. They would say, but you better fix this because the story doesn't work yet. They would spend years in that process often. Often radically changing story and character, and you know, Up started out with two princes in the air, right? That was the first version of Up.
You've done your research, man. Wow. I want to benefit from your research. Wow.
So, and that was all because production's so expensive, right? You're going to hire Tom Hanks to come do voiceover. You're going to spin up these massive compute systems to do, you know, full frame renders. That's really expensive. And so they wanted to do the cheap iteration first. And they called that planning. That's all pre-production. It's all planning, right? And I'm curious what you've seen studios do during that sort of pre-production approach to reduce risk and uncertainty during that really expensive, hey, we're spending six figures a day to shoot that production phase.
I'm going to actually answer a slightly different question, which is, what have I seen the best creatives do? It is, they recognize that it is not about them. For me, it's been a hallmark of mediocre writers, mediocre directors, where it's, well, this is my idea and I must protect and defend it, right? And it is the people who are incredibly confident, who have established themselves, that can have ideas that die. And it's fine. I mean, I remember the first time I was in a meeting at DreamWorks, you know, with Steven and the whole, when you meet with Steven, there are always like 6, 8, 10 people there, right? And I'm not going to give you the specifics of what it was he said, but imagine he said something like, yeah, you know, the alien should be vulnerable to, you know, coffee or whatever, right? Okay, great. And everyone sort of writes down, Steve wants, you know, alien coffee,
Yeah.
And then the coffee guy will walk through the room and be like, actually, you know what? That was in Signs or something. Why don't you make it about the aliens vulnerable to this other thing? And in a mediocre meeting, people are like, he contradicted Steven. And in that meaning, it's like Steven goes, yeah, that's a better idea. Let's do that. And the meeting just moves on. And there's no like Steven's idea died. There's no coffee guy being fired and shown to the front gates of the studio. There's like, I want this to be great. Best idea wins, man. Yeah. His idea is good. Let's run with that. And that was really interesting to me to see when you're creatively that confident, say like, it's not about my idea. It's about the project. So that's when you talk about like the Pixar process. That's the thing that's interesting where it's like, hey man, if like the five of us could get together and watch this together, like I would love to know what you think could be better. Like throw your ideas in. I'm going to take the best ones.
Yeah. So key to that is a process that allows for iteration and feedback, right?
True.
You have to have something to show and you have to have people to trust to give you good feedback.
Which it maps beautifully onto tech.
Some of that is in person. Like when I got started in tech, it was all, we were in the conference room. Eventually we acquired another company, sort of an acqui-hire, that was in Hamburg, Germany, that had been at Steinberg previously, another audio company. And then we got to experience a little bit of what it's like to do some of these things remotely and figure some of that stuff out. And I know that film historically has had different phases where there's remote, there's in-person, there's hybrid. Can you tell us a little bit about that process?
That is such a great question. Yes. Something that I noticed, and this is really what inspired my current company, was when I left Fox and I said, you know what? I want to go have more agency. I want to create things I believe in rather than just shepherding Die Hard 5 through, which there was no good idea in Die Hard 5. What else do I know how to do? Which is really engineering, right? So I was like, let's go create a startup. Let's find some problems. Let's try and solve it, right? So that's what I've been doing. So the pandemic happens. Zoom becomes a verb, you know, and a lot of verticals are like, ooh, what do we do? You know, we can't be in the same room without risking each other's health. Like we're now in this remote thing. And it was very shocked to the system in many verticals. For me, it was like film for 100 years has had remote, hybrid, in-person, exactly as you said, but it's not called that. In a film, it begins with writers working from each other's, you know, living rooms and coffee shops, and one idea gets some traction and you suddenly have a production office, and 2 days a week you're meeting with location scouts and production designers, and 3 days a week you're back in the coffee shop, you know, writing and doing script revisions to try and get Brad Pitt to be in your movie or something, right? And then you're on set, it's $125,000 a day. You know, you're there all day and all night, and it's... No one calls those periods, well, I'm in the remote period of the film. I'm in the hybrid period. You know, it's pre-production, it's post-production, it's that. So that was something where I was like, wow, I've seen some great examples of how to lead through these remote and hybrid, you know, periods, and also be an IC in them and know how to contribute and how to, you know, navigate that. Mm-hmm. So that's really what inspired the Suka Company, you know, for me, was like, how do you bring this sense of doing great work to people who maybe are not sitting in a cubicle under fluorescent lights all day long with their boss leaning over asking them about TPS reports.
which hopefully none of our listeners are experiencing. If you're experiencing that, please reach out. Send your boss to our next leadership class.
Right, we'll send him with some flair.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, tell us a little bit more about Suka. Like, what I know about Suka is it's an app. It's focused on sort of creating flow states, but that's about all I know about it. So tell our listeners what they should know about Suka.
This is true. It's just a simple web app. It's a website. I will tell you this. Necessity is the mother of invention, right? For me, pain was the mother of invention. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to tell you some things that I wrestle with, and you guys think I'm stupid and bad and awful, unless you're like, oh God, I have that too, right? Mm-hmm. So there were a couple things that I had that were painful. I'm going to tell you one I call now the cold start problem, which is tomorrow morning at 9, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to start doing this thing and get this done, bang out, have this great morning. And then tomorrow morning at 9:15, I'd find myself still returning emails out of my inbox, scrolling through the news, let me just find what's going on. 9:30, kind of getting going. And I'd pay the price for that at the end of the day, where I'm like, ugh, I didn't finish. I got to go to dinner. Laura needs me to, okay, you know what? I'm going to get up early tomorrow and get a jump on the stuff I didn't finish today and then do tomorrow's work, right? You tell yourself that lie and it dominoes through the week and it's frustrating and you start to feel frustrated with yourself and down on yourself, right? I was there. I looked at that and I said, much like you would with a character in a movie, if you understand the character, you can kind of understand what the character will do and whether they will solve that by the end of the movie and it's a success or they will not and it's a tragedy, right? So for me, I was like, what is it at 9 a.m. where I'm just not doing the thing that I know I should be doing? And I end up in this painful thing at the end of the day. And I was like, okay, so I'm procrastinating. Let's call it what it is. Well, why am I procrastinating? Well, I realized I felt overwhelmed. And it was overwhelmed was one of two things. It was, I look at my task list. I'm like, I can't get all 17 things. They all need to be done. I'm not going to get them done before my 11 a.m., you know, with Peter and Rich. Like, where do I start? And there's this paralysis around like, there are too many things. Or there was one thing on the list that was just ridiculous. It was like, oh yeah, I know I need to write my book or finish the slide deck for 2 weeks from now. It's not going to happen between now and 11. How even start, right? So that pain for me, Peter, was really the beginning of this exploration about, hey, a lot of smart people have written about these kind of problems. These are not new under the sun. And once you read, you know, Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, and you read Cal Newport, whom I got to meet, Nir, whom I got to meet, James Clear, like a lot of these people, they have a lot of tips. Be super blunt. If you read all 12 of those top books, there is a lot of commonality. Like, right, they all agree on the principles. They have their own vocabulary. They have their own frameworks with cute, you know, like acronyms to remember their stuff, right? They have to sell you their book for $24.95, but there's a lot of agreement around that. So I thought, how can you take all of these things that are really like solutions to this problem and just put it behind one button? How could I open a website, have one button, and that one button gave me the tools to overcome this? So in this case, we built a smart assistant. When I opened Suka, you know, my website in the morning, hit play, and yeah, you get focus music and you get Pomodoro timers and all this stuff, right? Table stakes. But one of the cool things is your smart assistant looks at your task list and says, hey, Peter, you have 17 things. You're not going to do them all. Which three are important? And then it will pull out those three, or you can add something to it. And as soon as you start working, it'll hide the other 14. So in your field of view, you just have those three, and suddenly it's a lot more accomplishable. We found that actually with our members, there's a 77% better chance they'll finish all three if they can only see three than the old days when they could say three, they would finish two.
Interesting.
It's just like, yeah, you can multitask and jump around. You start to paralysis. Same thing if there's something on there that's ridiculously huge. Oh, do that presentation for next June, whatever. No, you're not going to get that done right now. So it'll break it down. Say like, hey, instead of writing your book this morning, why don't you make your task outline chapter three?
Uh-huh.
And right, it becomes doable. So really, that's what I built was on this concept of flow states, which, you know, I'm happy to talk about. How do we just make it one button? Take all this great knowledge, say, here's one button, help me.
Uh-huh, right. I think many of our listeners will be familiar with Csikszentmihalyi and the research on flow. But for those that aren't, why don't you give like high level, here's what a flow state is, here's what's required to get in it, and here's what's going to get you out of it.
Let's do it. I'll try to be as concise as possible.
Okay.
So there is a seminal book called Flow by Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. And we were talking about, he's a Hungarian-American psychologist. And he said, there is this concentrated state that high performers seem to get into. And they do their great work in this state, right? The world falls away. Time falls away. What is it? How do they do it? Can it be quantified? Can I, you know, like Prometheus, bring fire down to the common people? And you may know this concept under different names. There's the famous Michael Jordan quote about being in the zone, where he's like, it's just me and the ball. He's like, in other words, I don't see the scoreboard. I don't see the defenders. When I'm in that zone, I'm unstoppable. And going back to the thing I said earlier, which is I have a strong thesis that there's something great in all of us. The question is just simply, are you going to get it out or not? Are you going to scroll and waste your life? Or are you going to say, let me dig down and like show the world this is of what I'm capable, right? Mm-hmm. So Mihaly wrote the book Flow after studying all of these different disciplines, high performers, and said, I'm going to call it flow because I love this metaphor of you can paddle and sort of your effort carries you forward. But if you're doing this in a certain way, it's like the river begins to magnify your effort. And that's a flow state. So if you have ever been working and it just had that feeling of like you look up and time's gone by and you've done all this stuff and you haven't been distracted to go to the bathroom or get a snack or whatever, you've been in a flow state. And there are now conditions, precedent that help that happen. And that's really what we've studied. That's how I built my platform.
Uh-huh. What are a few of those conditions? I know there are several, but a few of the conditions that are required to get into a flow state.
Some of the things Mihaly found is he said, number one, you have to have skills that apply. Like Michael Jordan painting or Picasso playing basketball, you're not going to go to flow state. It's just not, you know, you have to be challenged. So it's not, to use the same metaphor to death, it's not Michael Jordan play with eighth graders, right? Is Michael Jordan playing in the NBA and being challenged to win the championship that you get into that state, right? So you have to have skills, be challenged. You have to also believe it's meaningful.
Mm.
It's not brushing your teeth.
Mm-hmm.
It's not doing a TPS report that, you know, no one's even going to use or read.
Yeah.
It is something where you go, wow, if I bring this into the staff meeting, people are going to be like, this changes the trajectory of our company.
Yeah.
This is a great idea. Everyone should run that direction, what Peter just said, right? So it's that kind of thing. Absolutely, it's meaningful. There are some others, and there are also some sort of cheats or, you know, tips to get into flow states. One of the ones that, I mean, you obviously have an audio background, is there's an oral environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of research that there's certain kinds of music that help most of us get into flow. Most of it is 60 to 90 beats per minute, certain key signatures, like ambient, non-vocal.
Yeah.
Yes, we all have the friend that only gets in a flow state when she listens to 90s gangster rap. God bless. We all have that friend.
But we're not going to, with a whole bunch of software developers listening, we're not going to get into those debates right now. What do you listen to when you're coding?
People have their thing, and some people swear by binaural beats.
Yeah.
You know, like in our platform, happily, I have a bunch of friends who are film composers with time on their hands. Like 1,000 hours of flow music written to best practices. Some of the members were like, I'm into binaural beats. And I read about it. I learned it. Yeah. Oh, I was like, I get it now. So we launched binaural beats where you have, you know, a delta between your left and right channels. And, you know, you have to have headphones because you have to be able to feed your brain two different channels.
Right.
But lots of things like that.
I'm a big adherent. Like that's me. I have binaural stuff I put on when I'm trying to write. And
what delta, what hertz difference do you use?
I don't remember, because when I was researching this, I found, at the time it was like a subscription, and they had several, you know, like hour-long MP3s that came with this subscription. Yep. And there was one for Creative Flow, there was one for more meditative states. And I just downloaded the whole thing, and I've used them ever since because they work. It actually cured my insomnia when I got this stuff. And
I
can put those
cool.
on, and I could go into a meditative state. And now I can almost imagine having the headphones on, and I can imagine the feeling of like the meditative state one, and I can go into a meditative state like that.
Is that amazing? It's really your cool. brain can trigger that. And by the way, the TLDR for anyone listening about this is depending on how many cycles different your left and right ear are, there are research theories being solidified about whether it stimulates certain kinds of brain waves, alpha, delta, gamma, and that some of them, as Peter said, that seems to encourage people in a creative mind, or that seems to encourage focus, or that seems to encourage, you know, like sleep, things like that. So I experiment with your own, and this would be a little tangent, so flag me if you don't want to do this,
okay.
Peter. Fair?
We'll cut it out later if we need to.
Exactly. So this is all gone, right? And the lottery tickets today are. No. So what you said about how now your brain triggers into, oh, right, I'm going to that place. I'll tell you something that I saw in film, and incredibly true now, I've seen across any kind of productivity, which is space. The way spaces, you can train your brain to say, I am within this space now. This is where I do this thing, right? And I saw this originally back with Roland and Dean, whom you brought up. Roland and Dean had written their last couple movies at this apparently beautiful villa down in the hills of Puerto Vallarta. Mm-hmm. White marble, the whole thing. And they talked about there was this room where in the morning the light came over the pool and just inspired them. And they'd written like Universal Soldier and Stargate and stuff like that, right? So when they were off to write Independence Day, Roland told Joey, his assistant, you know, go rent the villa, Joey, right?
Yeah.
Joey came back that day and was like, it's rented. Around the office was like, oh my God, what's going to happen, right? Roland called John Deemer, his entertainment attorney. He was a fantastic attorney, by the way. John, buy the villa. By Monday, Roland owned a villa in Puerto Vallarta. The renters who were there, I do not know where they went. Yeah, I'm sure they're nicely paid to not be there. Uh-huh. And Roland Dean went down into that space and they wrote the third highest grossing movie in film history at the time, right? Mm-hmm. That triggered for them that thing. But it does not have to be this high end, like I'm in this $5 million villa. You know, like Alex and Bob, with whom I worked, they wrote God knows how many billions of dollars of box office, right? The Star Trek and Transformers. They had met back in their school years, right? Like Bob had been a UT student who dropped out, and you know, Alex was at Crossroads. When we were at Amblin, which is the little DreamWorks area of the Universal lot, and they had to buckle down and write. It was like, okay, the deadline of Transformers 2 is coming, whatever it was. They had their assistant rent a room at the Universal Hilton across the street, which is not a luxury property, to put it politely. But they would go hunker down there and get it done. And for them, it was that mental trigger, which I think it evoked dorm room. Uh-huh. I think that's why that was their space. Because it's like, oh, we're those scrappy guys with Bob sitting on the edge of the bed with his laptop and Alex at the, you know, little rinky-dink desk. Because that was their mental space of getting back to, someday we're going to be these great writers and we're going to, you know. So that can be applied. That is a free technique. You don't need my app, anybody's app. That is simply, you know what? Instead of using my house where it's like in the morning, I work at the kitchen table, in the afternoon, I'm on the sofa, in the morning, you know, say to yourself, you know what? This kind of work is going to be in this space. And when I enter the space, my mind is going to clear and say, oh, you're here now to do that. You're here to code. Or this is where I do my designs. This is where I do that thing. Free technique. I've watched it true with so many writers and directors, so many designer UI, UX people, you know, developers. Yeah. It's awesome.
I love that technique. That's great. Curious, what have been some of the challenges as you've brought Suka to market?
It has taken me 6 years to get to the point where people share it virally. Mm-hmm. Like we don't do any paid ads. We don't do any paid anything. That took a while to get that right. I'll tell you, there are a couple things where I was like, I don't know if this feature is a good idea. Mm-hmm. I have a sense of it, but I'll give you one example. In the original version of this, we were saying, what are things that help people get into flow, right? And one of the things, as you know, is it takes a few minutes to get into flow. You do not press a button and 3 seconds later, you're like, I'm in a flow state. most of the research, 15 to 25 minutes, right? Including when you're in a flow state and you get interrupted, it's another 15 to 25 right. to get back in, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. So block your distractions. So yeah, logically what you build, if you're in my shoes, you're like, oh, we should have a little smart assistant monitor, you know, what you're doing. And if you open Facebook and you can customize your little list, man, if I'm in Facebook or CNN or Twitter, whatever, nudge me. You open up CNN and your assistant's like, hey, Peter, do you really need to be in CNN right now? And you're like, oh, actually, no, I'd rather finish at 5 and be not stressed than surf the news right now, uh-huh. right? So it does that. Super helpful, right? Single player game. I had a thesis. It's like, I'm speaking to so many members individually. They have no sense of each other. They don't realize there are thousands of other people in here all trying to do something similar. They're trying to all focus. They're trying to write their code or do their UI designs, right? So I had this idea, what if we had a group chat? What if we actually made this kind of social? My wife works in banking. And I remember when Venmo came out and I was like, wow, they looked like Instagram where like the atomic unit was the image, right? Or they looked at Twitter where the atomic unit was that text and everything gets built on that atomic unit. And they said, what if the atomic unit was a payment? Mm-hmm. Hey, Rich paid the babysitter. And then Peter posts a funny emoji of a dog, you know, or like, hey man, hope you had a fun, whatever, right? That was brilliant. I didn't see that coming. Laura didn't see that coming, but man, that took all that crazy. And I thought, what if the atomic unit is what you got done? So once a day you could post like, hey, I published my new website. And people could be like, oh man, hey, give us the URL. Let's go see what you did, right? So I was thinking building this, but then I also thought, is that going to be distracting AF?
Right, right. It's trade-off, right?
Are people going to be like, oh my God, this is terrible. So I asked some members. I was like, hey, I'm thinking of kind of, da-da-da. And I'm going to tell you, there was, she's still a member. I'm not going to name her right now, but I ran this by her and she said, sure, I'll talk to you about that for a minute. So we Zoomed and I said, what do you think? Distracting or like helpful? And she said, Stephen, this is how I would think about it if I were you. She said, I can go to the Nike store and I can buy a pair of shoes. They will sell me a left shoe and a right shoe. I can put them on my feet. I can go run. Works great. There's a reason why 100 million people belong to the Nike Run Club. Because when you run together, you run faster, you run farther, you're more accountable. The days you feel like a slug and you're on the sofa, you're in bed and your friend's like, come on, let's go do this. You get up and do it and you feel great. And even better, the days when they need you to be the one to say, come on, Rich, let's do this. It feels great to be that one who lifts someone else up. She's like, I would do it. Can I tell you, it is my favorite feature in Sugo. More than the smart assistant, more than the music, more than the Pomodoro timers, all that stuff. That is my favorite thing, of the sense of, oh, this is a whole community of people who are trying to do something with their life.
That's really, really interesting. The power of social connection that for years, most tech workers had in the office, whether they complained about it or not, right? Or grumbled about it or not, there is a power to social connection on a team. There's a power to accountability, peer accountability. There's a power to the quote unquote water cooler chats, right? Of sort of cross-pollination of ideas and information. And I think that's really missing in a lot of the tools and a lot of the approaches today. So that's really interesting to see that play out in Suka as well.
I appreciate you saying that. It is a risk I took, and it now is my favorite thing to feel. I wake up in the morning, I'm like, let's see who's in there chatting. Mm-hmm. Every now and then I'll post something and people will be like, oh, that's really cool, you know? Yeah. It just feels different.
There's the book Social, describes the research that the default brain state of humans is not off, it's not resting, it's where are my people?
Yeah.
When we're at rest, we're seeking connection. That's the default state of our brain. So very interesting. Yeah. So you strike me as a very centered, focused person, Stephen. And I'm curious, our world is not a place that encourages that, right? It feels like we're actively discouraged from being centered and focused with all the uncertainty and stress of sort of the political and economic climate. What advice do you have for our audience about how to stay centered and focused?
Okay. Let me dispel your notion.
Okay.
I am medically diagnosed with ADD, right?
Yeah.
I am absolutely the squirrel, shiny object. Hey, you know, that is something I've wrestled with for a long time and took me until doing this to really go to a doctor and say, like, this is how my brain works. And then be like, oh, you're like classic kind of ADD, not really presenting as hyperactive, but I believed multitasking was a thing. It's not a thing.
Right.
It's monotasking with context switching and burning your brain, right? But like those sort of things to me were like super available. So I appreciate your saying that because it makes me feel like I've done some work. I'm getting better. But I struggle with that every single day, right? It is why I told you to think about like, I only want to see the three things I'm working on right now. Don't show me 17 things while I'm working because I will jump around and I'll get discouraged and stuff like that, right? So I think a couple things have helped me. One, I have a daily yoga practice. And I absolutely notice the days that I practice, the clarity of my thought is different. Full stop. There's something about that hour of just being unable to think about, oh, well, I got to do those new designs in Figma, or I wonder, I should probably do some little backlog grooming and linear. Like, I'm on one leg, try my best not to fall down in front of other people and just don't want to be embarrassed and just want to have that moment of like, wow, I feel centered today. So that really has helped me. It's also how I met Laura, my wife. So
double bonus.
Big fan. Double bonus, exactly. Big fan of the yoga. It is also how I named my company. Sukha is a Sanskrit term you hear in yoga. It's about the happiness you feel when you're self-fulfilled, when you're doing something. You're in your lane, you're doing something well, and you can do it with ease. And that's my company name, the Sukha Company, is the happiness company. Because that's ultimately what I want to do. It's not, hey man, we're the Pomodoro timer distraction blocker 14 app, you know?
Right.
It is, I want someone to look up at 3 o'clock and be like, I feel great and I'm done for the day. That's a nice feeling.
Yeah. If Sukha is wildly successful, 20 years from now, how do you hope the world's different?
I hope, and it is such an interesting question to ask today in June of 2025, as people are debating, will AI do my job? Will I work for AI? Are the robots going to eat me? I hope that Sukha enables people to do the thing that to create the great thing that is inside them, right? And yes, maybe some of the AI tools are levers that help that happen. The way I hope AI works in our world is not that we're going to go to Usain Bolt and say, Usain, we have this robot that runs faster than you, so why don't you just sit here and we'll just all watch the robot. But rather it's saying, hey, with AI, we actually examined your foot and we have a shoe that's just 1% stickier. So you might be able to shave a second off your time because Usain would be happier about that and so would the spectators. So my hope is that Sukha becomes that kind of application where it's like, it's a community of people who support each other, want to see each other succeed, share tips, and enable each other to do great things. And, you know, I'm having a son this year, as you know, I think you know. And how my children are going to look at what I did, I think will be more formed by Sukha than by any movie I worked on. You know, the Wolverine, the sequel didn't change the world. You know what I mean? Like Transformers didn't change the world. But if, man, a billion people could feel like, hey, this tool, it helps me do great things, more focused, I feel healthier and happier. Yeah, that's the thing I'm going to tell my son that I did, and eventually my daughter. Yeah.
I think that's a good place to wrap it.
There we go.
Stephen, thank you for your time today. Lots of really interesting stuff. I'm sure our listeners will find both some some fun stories, but also some things that will help them to be more focused, to make a bigger difference in their work, and to have more ease and joy in doing it. So thanks for being with us, and thanks for everybody that tuned in to this episode of the Humanizing Work Show.
Thank you guys for having me on, and if I can help anyone, please, you know, put my email in the show notes.
We'll put all your contact info in there. Thesukha.com. Is it .com? Remind me.
.co.
.co.
So thesukha.co for the Sukha Company.
And we'll drop that in the show notes for everyone
super cool.
to check it out. And I know there's a free trial on there. So go check out the trial. Try it out, folks.
There you go. No credit card. No gimmicks.
Great. Thanks, Stephen.
Okay. Thank you, guys.